I also want to begin by thanking Sarah Zimmerman for sponsoring this year and Rabbi Breidowitz this year, to thank Hashem for all his blessings and allowing her to make Aliyah for the second and last time. Mirtz Hashem, we are so excited. I thought when I saw Sarah here a few weeks ago, I thought she was here for a few weeks for a visit, and she's like, no, I am really here this time. So we're very, very excited.
Hi, everybody. As you know, I had a very brief trip to the United States, and I come back, and the whole place gets topsy-turvy, so I say I better not leave that often. Anyway, the other thing that this reminds me of, when Mrs. Siegel said about, if you didn't understand the Hebrew, you shouldn't go to the shir, you know, somebody told me, I never checked this out, that Satmir has a website to explain the philosophy of Satmir Hasidus, but the first home page is in Yiddish, and the Yiddish says, if you can read this, get off. And then... So it's a similar idea. Anyway, we are looking at the book of Mishlei, but two weeks ago, we had a digression, and I need to continue it to fully understand this. Remember that Mishlei is called Sefer HaChachma, the book of wisdom, but Chachma in Mishlei does not refer to intellect, and it does not refer to knowledge of facts, even of knowledge of Torah. But rather, Chachma refers to the knowledge of right and wrong, to an understanding of what life is about, what is the purpose of life, and what are the goals to which you should direct your efforts. Now, it doesn't yet mean you have self-control. This is why it's called the Book of Chachma and Musar, because it's important to know that Chachma and Musar are intimately connected, but they are distinct ideas. Ultimately, Chachma is intellectual, but it's not intellectual in the sense of how much Gemara you know or how many mathematical equations. It is the knowledge of what is right, what is wrong, and what should the goals of my life be. That is what a Chacham is. But even if you're a Chacham and you know all that, we still may lack the discipline, the self-control, to be able to implement. I mean, after all, how many things that we know we should be doing that we're not always able to do? So Musar is the specific mechanisms that one has in their life. It might be tricks, it might be other types of things, in which one learns to control their Yetzer Hara and direct it in a promising, challenging way. Now you understand, you need both aspects for moral education. Because if you have Musar, but you don't really understand the direction you should be going, then you're moving real quickly, but you're going the wrong way. And that's very important. Sometimes in Yiddishkeit, for example, a person might become very, very zealous to be machmir, 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 take on every little chumrah, which in the abstract might be a good thing. But that might be at the expense of shalom bayis. It might be at the expense of taking care of his children. It might be at the expense of covered up rios generally. So the person thinks he's a tzaddik, he's growing in his ruchnius, when in fact he's going in the totally wrong direction. That is where chachma comes in. You understand what your duties are. You understand the prioritization of the duties. You understand that when things are in conflict, through guidance and learning, you try to understand what is more important. I'm not suggesting simplistically that there's a single answer for this, but those are the types of questions that Chachma addresses. Musar then becomes the ability to actually carry out the Chachma by discipline and by training oneself and the like. And that is why the dominant words that Shlomo HaMelech uses are Chachma and Musar. Now, what our digression was last week is I was talking about the so-called modern Musar movement of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And last time we had gone over, I think, the biography of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and much of his basic teachings. Let me just reiterate as a segue to some new material that you'll remember that the Musar movement that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter envisioned, which was designed to be a strengthening of Yiras Hashem generally, and in particular Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, the idea of Midos, Tovos, and the like, because he saw in his time that even among the Torah community, there was a certain hisrashlut, there was a certain not taking seriously interpersonal relationships, and Rabbi Yisrael wanted to strengthen that. And you'll recall that in his Musar movement there were three components. Component number one, we might actually call chachma, although he didn't use the word chachma, he called everything Musar, but in his Musar is included chachma. In fact, by the way, there are great svarim of the Balei Musar after Rabbi Yisrael. They're called Chachma u'Musar, Rabbi Yerucham of Mir, and I'll tell you who these people are. His svarim are called Chachma u'Musar. So, but what he called it, what we would call Chachma, he called Musar bi'iyun. Iyun, right? We talk about learning Gemara bi'iyun. Iyun is in depth. This involves studying the Gemaras and the Midrashim, which deal with midos and character, with the same intellectual depth that you study every other part of the Torah. Right? A Talmud Chacham would study the laws of Shabbos in depth, the laws of Kashrus in depth. So too, you study the laws of business ethics, the laws of not taking revenge, the laws of not getting angry. One does it be'ion. And this ion itself took multiple forms. Right? Ion just means in-depth learning. It involved, number one, studying the Sifrei Musar, such as Chovos HaLevavos, Mesila Shesharim. Remember, all the Sifrei Musar are much older than Rabbi Yisrael. Musar Svarim. Musar Svarim go back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. But he was the one that created the idea of studying them intensively, and actually for long periods of time. He created, in a number of cities in Europe, what were called Batei Musar, houses of Musar, where you'd walk in and there weren't even Gemaras or Chumashim, because we didn't want you to get distracted. You would focus on the Musar Svarim. There is in Yerushalayim a base Musar that Rav Alba, Zichrono Livracha, used to teach and be very, very involved in. And this was not only for Bnei Yeshiva. He envisioned working Balabatim. Would take an hour off the day to learn the books of Musar with the theory that they would get the chachma of what is life about. By the way, it's interesting that Rabbi Yisrael, this was one of Rabbi Yisrael's innovations that actually was very controversial. Some great rabbis didn't like the idea of creating a special house for Musar, as if you're making Musar a separate religion. We have a base medrash, Gemara, Shulchan Aruch, Sifrei Musar. Why are you creating a separate house? And they even had a bit of a humorous interpretation of the pasuk. We say in Hallel, Beis Aaron, Yiruas Hashem, right? Ezra, right? The house of Aaron should fear Hashem, etc. And then it says, Yirei Hashem. Yeah, right? So it points out, it doesn't say Beis Yirei Hashem, meaning Aaron, has a house, Kohanim have a house, but Yirei Shemayim shouldn't have its own house. It belongs in every place. You don't have a base Yirei Hashem and the like. So this was Musar Be'ian, and the Musar Be'ian was an intellectual endeavor in which you analyze, you raise questions. I think I had mentioned, for example, that Rav Yisrael had very interesting Piskei Halacha based on Musar. For example, Rav Yisrael Salanter Paskins, that although the halacha is very clear that if I sin against you, Yom Kippur does not give me forgiveness unless I ask Mechila, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter Paskin, if I spoke Lashon Hara against you, and by telling you what I did, I would cause more embarrassment and hurt to you, I am not supposed to ask your Mechila and tell you what I did, because that would just make the pain worse, and I would be a tzaddik and somebody else cheshman. The Chafetz Chaim in the Sefer Shmiras Chafetz Chaim argues with that. That's the one point where the Chafetz Chaim, who came later, argued with Rav Yisrael Salanter, but Rav Aaron Cutler said, in these inyanim, we paskin like Rav Yisrael Salanter. Right, so that's the Musar Be'iyun. The second component, again, this is by way of quick review, was called Musar Be'hispalut, Hispilus, Hispa'alutz, or Hispa'alutz, as we pronounce it in Yiddish, refers to emotional arousal. And that was the idea that from the head, you don't really get to the heart. And this would involve taking a Maimer Chazal or a Pasuk, and just saying it over and over and over again, maybe 100 times, maybe 200 times, for a whole hour, till it finally affects you on an emotional, deep emotional level. So it might be Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It might be Histakel B'Shloisha Devarim, like you hear this at the Yerushalmi funerals. Look at three things and you will not come Lidei Chet Me'ayin Basa. And people would say that, and they would often cry and bring themselves to tears and emotional arousal, etc. And this was called Musar B'Hispalos, because Rabbi Sosalander said, Musar B'Ion informs your mind, but it doesn't necessarily change your heart. There had to be time for emotional excitement, so to speak. And the third was the actual application of strategies through Musar Vadim. We'll call it religious group therapy, in which chaverim would meet together under the guidance of a rebbe or a rav or a teacher, and they would discuss the actual problems they face in building up their midos, in becoming better. They would discuss their failures. They would discuss their successes. And together they would try to work on practical strategies for how to deal with life, meaning how to, for example, how to be, and they would take projects. They would take projects. This month we're going to work on Mekabel Kol Adam B'Sever Panim Yafos, that we greet everybody with a pleasant countenance. And they would say, how should we do this? Let's say, and they would say, let's say you had a bad day. Let's say, you know, you had a big business loss, or something happened, there's sickness in the family. And you're very, very anxious, and you're very, very concerned. And then you meet somebody and you're not really in the mood. Right? In other words, they would discuss this. What do you do under those circumstances? Right? Group therapy, so to speak. But not simply because of psychology, but with the desire and the agenda to grow in Avodas Hashem. Now, Baruch Hashem, this is an idea that although a lot of the Musar movement became dormant for many, many years, in recent years, this has actually come back to Klal Yisrael. And this is the famous, the pretty well-known Musar Vadim that now exists in Eretz Yisrael, and some of them exist in Chutz Laaretz as well. It's called a Musar Vad, meaning a Vad just means a group together. Of course, as is always the case, more women are involved than men. I guess we men have such perfect midos we don't really need. We don't need Vadim and things like that, so I'm glad that you're working on yourselves. But there are men who do it also. And it's written...
Third strategy, what's it called?
Well, there's no particular word for it, but I would just say a practical, let's call it Vaadim, which is to work on Lamaisa. And this, except for the Musar Vad, which is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful concept, this was, until recently, until this got reestablished, this was the main part of the Musar movement that simply got extinct. Because what happened was, in all yeshivas, they do give lip service to Musar. And what does that mean? They just take a Musar book and they learn it. So first of all, they don't even learn it be'in. So that's one thing. So they don't even do Musar be'in, but at least in an attenuated way, they're learning a book. But take that book and apply it in your real life, and to open yourself up, which takes a lot of guts actually, takes a lot of courage, to open yourself up and to discuss. That was something that was virtually extinct. But Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought it back. Some great people did bring it back. And it's a wonderful thing. Once again, this was very controversial, though. Yeah, because you understand, it was something new. In other words, you understand, Musar B'Ion was not such a new thing. After all, the Mesilas Yesharim had existed way before Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Shari Tshuva was even older. Chovos HaLevavos was even older. So all of these books existed. And people were learning these books. So the Musar B'Ion, although Rabbi Yisrael made it more intensive, was not really the chiddush of the Musar movement. Even the opponents of the Musar movement learned these svarim. At least the tzaddikim. I mean, there were some opponents who were not, but the righteous opponents learned these svarim. Yeah?
I'm not getting what's Musar B'Ion.
Musar B'Ion is studying the ethical texts in great depth.
Iyun
is studying something in depth. Iyun, yeah. So the real innovation was the Musar B'Hispilus, which some consider to be too esoteric, maybe even Hasidic, which again, in the Litvish circles, Hasidus Bechlal was suspect. And the group therapy thing that they say smack too much of Sigmund Freud, you know, etc. And that was a bit controversial, to open yourself up and the like. But Rabbi Yisrael considered that to be absolutely necessary, because it is not enough to know the theory of character development. You have to know the practice. And the practice involves techniques. It involves honesty. It involves the willingness to discuss with people who can help you, and you can help them. And once again, as I say, if you read, you can actually get information even on the internet, assuming you have the internet, about Musar Vadim, and you can see the way people describe how it is a life-transforming type of experience. And it starts off very often with very small things, not necessarily big things, such as my kid broke a glass and spilled the milk today, and I yelled at them. What do I do about that? And the theory behind this is that when you learn how to deal with small issues, you get the spiritual stamina, spiritual muscle, so to speak, to deal with the major issues. And it's easier to deal with small issues because there's sometimes less of an emotional static. For very, very big issues, you know, one is sometimes too distraught to be able to focus. On smaller issues, you know, we can deal with it. And then you get the resources. So it is really group therapy, but as I say, not merely from a psychological standpoint, but it's a spiritual endeavor to become close to Hashem, to grow in emuna, to grow in bitachon, to refine midos, etc. And Rabbi Saul Salanter envisioned this as a very, very ambitious plan that would be all over the place. For Balabatim, there would be one type of Musar regimen. For B'nai Yeshiva, there would be another type, and each would have according to their level. The B'nai Yeshiva would be able to learn the sugyas, learn the ideas in much more depth and detail, and the Balabatim would, you know, who were not capable necessarily, or didn't have the time, would have it in a more simplified way. But he really saw this as very broad-based. And that is why, although Rabbi Saul Salanter himself was a certain classical, brilliant, genius gadol, but he spent a lot of his time, as he said, in France and Germany, in places where there were very, very few religious Jews. His great disciples he left in Vilna, but he himself traveled all over the place, worked with college students. He met with Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who was reviving Orthodoxy in Germany, and he wanted to translate the Talmud into German for university students. He had many, many, many projects, a lot of which he was not able to get off the ground because he didn't have money, etc. In fact, he was so devoted that he taught himself German, which again is not especially hard because it's close to Yiddish, but he actually taught himself German to be able to start translating it himself and the like. So he was just a great, great, great visionary. Although, as I say, it is recorded by some that he did suffer from depression, and there were times that he literally could not get out of bed. And yet, if anything, the fact that he pushed himself for all of those years is really a great, great tribute to the fact that he did not allow his, you know, mental and emotional condition to affect him in any way. He pushed himself until the very last moment, and as I indicated, he died in a garret in an attic in France, and his roommate was an old man, an old beggar, and when he saw the old beggar was afraid that he would be in a room with a dead body, Rabbi Yisrael spent his last minutes on earth telling the beggar that he shouldn't be afraid. That, in other words, imagine this, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter would have so much to do before he leaves this world, but he didn't want the beggar to be afraid, and he wanted to give him the chama. Yeah. He did have a family, and again, it's not entirely clear. His wife, I believe, stayed in the Vilna area, and he would be back a few times a year, but they were largely, most of the year, they were not together. And I think I did mention that he had a number of children. Some of the children became great Talmidei Chachamim. One of the children became a very, very famous professor of mathematics who was not religious. And in fact, in trigonometry, he developed something called the Lipkin. Lipkin is the family name. The Lipkin parallelogram, which is something in trigonometry. And I think I had mentioned that the Maskilim, really were very happy of this, because here this great rabbi of the Orthodox Jews, his son has a secular education and is a modern person. So they put full page ads in the Yiddish papers saying, "We want to congratulate Rabbi Yisrael Salanter on the great accomplishments of his son, who has become a modern Jew, conversant with the ways of the world, and we are sure this is a result of the excellent training and education that he got from his father." Yeah.
He had a great-great-grandson was Ramat Kala.
That's correct. That's correct.
Lipkin Shachar.
Yeah, Lipkin Shachar, right, who died recently, right?
That was a direct descendant.
That's correct. Now, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter could not allow that to pass, because that would be a Chilul Hashem, and that would imply that he agreed with that assessment. So he had to put in a counter ad in the paper, basically saying, "I love my son deeply, but I am very, very sad over the choices he made in his life. And if there's anyone that could be mashpia on my son to come back to the Torah, I would be greatly in his debt." So he had to actually do that and the like. Okay. Now, yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna get to that now. Now, what I want to talk about today is Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, although he spent much of his years in France and Germany, going from place to place, dealing with college students and balabatim, he did have a core of very, very great disciples, Gedolei Torah themselves, who were concentrated in the Vilna area. And, you know, one could come up with probably 20 or 30, but I'm going to mention five great, great disciples who established distinct schools. And this is, I think, literally where we ended off. And that is, we have three altars, and then I'll mention two others. There are three people that are known as the old man. There is the altar of Kelim, the old man of Kelim. These are all cities in Lithuania. The old man of Kelim is, his name is Rav Simcha Zissel Brody, or some say Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv. Sometimes it's Ziv Brody. Last names in Europe in those days are very confusing, because people are always changing their names to escape the army or whatever it is. So it's either Brody or Ziv or both. And called the Altar of Kelim. The second is Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the Altar of Slobodka. He is indeed the great-grandfather of the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, who bears the same name, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. And the third is Rav Yosef Yezel, which is Yezela, Rav Yosef Yezel Horovitz, the Altar of Navarduk, or Navargruduk, as it's sometimes pronounced, because in Russian you don't have an H, so every H, Navarduk, becomes Navargruduk. Now, what is interesting is this. The mark of a great Rebbe is that he's so multifaceted, and he embraces so many different approaches, that each student becomes kind of different, meaning they're not cookie-cutter people who are exactly the same, but they took different facets. Now, that's why it's so confusing. Sometimes, Lahavdil, it is like the children's story of the seven blind men and the elephant, where blind men touched an elephant, and they were asked, "What does an elephant feel like?" So one person who touched the trunk said, "Oh, an elephant is a long eel." And someone who touched the ear says, "An elephant is a gigantic butterfly." And somebody who put his hands around the stomach said, "Oh, an elephant is like a hippopotamus." And et cetera, et cetera. Each one felt a different thing. All of them were true, but it was only an incomplete truth, because the elephant was all of these things. The elephant has the trunk of an eel and the ears of a butterfly and the stomach of a hippopotamus, etc. So too, Rabbi Yisrael's Talmidim, each of them broke off different facets. Now, of all of the Talmidim, though, the one that knew Rabbi Yisrael the longest and the one that was the closest was indeed Rav Simcha Zissel, the Altar of Kelim. And Rav Simcha Zissel is very, 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 very interesting, because in a sense, one might say that just as the Hasidic movement may have been started by the Baal Shem Tov, but its true elaboration was by the Baal Shem Tov's successor, the Magid of Mezerich. So too, Rav Yisrael Salanter may have started what is called the Musar movement, but Rav Simcha Zissel was the real pioneer. In fact, I should point out, even in terms of the altars, even though I mentioned the altar of Slobodka and the altar of Novardik as being students of Rav Yisrael, because they came to Rav Yisrael towards the end of Rav Yisrael's life, they are almost equally, maybe even more so, students of Rav Simcha Zissel. So if you'd be drawing lines or charts, Rav Simcha Zissel is directly Rav Yisrael's Talmud for many, many years. The altar of Slobodka initially was Rav Yisrael's Talmud. He then connected to the altar of Kelem and the altar of Novardik the same way. Although we will see that those two other schools broke away from Kelem in very distinct ways. The altar of Kelem, if we had to summarize, and I'm going to be simple over here, the altar of Kelem's ultimate pedagogical tool was self-mastery and self-control. A person has to cultivate the idea of controlling yourself. You have mastery over yourself. You are in charge of your life. And therefore, to him, the supreme value was serenity, not getting upset, not being turbulent. He saw that all the mistakes people make in life, and I refer to spiritual mistakes, but even physical and financial and material mistakes, come when a person is in a state of inner turbulence and anxiety. So the mind does not function clearly. And therefore, his goal with all of his students was to teach the notion of serenity, self-control, not being adversely affected by what is happening outside of you. To float, as it was, above yourself, almost have an out-of-body experience in which you look down at yourself and you say, how is this person acting today? Why is he acting in such a foolish way? How did the altar of Kelem communicate this? He started a yeshiva, and this was called the Talmud Torah. It's a strange name, because Talmud Torah is a name that we associate with, you know, young children. But this was called the Talmud Torah of Kelem. But one has to remember this. In the Talmud Torah of Kelem, it is really what we call in Israel a yeshiva katana. It really was for boys of a high school age, although people did stay for many years, because he felt, unlike other yeshivas that were yeshiva gedolos, he felt his plan would not work in the yeshiva gedola level initially, because you had to get the kids when they were young and impressionable. You could not be an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old and go to Kelem. You had to be a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old. And Kelem was a regular yeshiva, of course. Obviously, the learning was very high. But there was a tremendous emphasis on all sorts of exercises that sound even a little crazy to teach people self-control, self-discipline, and serenity. So, for example, when you got a package from home, a food package from home, you had to share it with everybody, that you shouldn't just keep it for yourself, to learn to be generous and kind. When you got a letter from home, remember there was no email or phones in those days, you had to wait 24 hours before you open it, because a person shouldn't be like an animal, I gotta see what it is. You wait. After a fast, the minhag in Kelem was, you would be served fish with a lot of little bones in it. And the reason is because after a fast, people tend to eat ravenously and they eat quickly. And no, when you have bones, you got to eat slowly. The concept is slow down. You're not an animal. Slow down. Yeah.
Was any of his emphasis on serenity a reaction against Reverend depression?
Well, it might be. In fact, it may even be a reaction against his own depression. There is a bit of depression in the Baalei Musar. But the concept always was your mind. In fact, it's very similar to Chabad philosophy, actually. It's very, very interesting. The whole philosophy of Chabad is the mind controls the emotions. And Rav Simcha Zissel very much believed we can will ourselves not to get upset by the externalities of life. Another example, to teach boys the value of time, there was a Seder, a learning Seder, in the middle of the night, that only lasted for 5 or 10 minutes, no more, no less. So I don't remember the exact time, but there was a learning seder from 12 to 12.05. Now, when you have 2 hours to learn, so you come 5 minutes late, no big deal. But when you have 5 minutes to learn, you better make it on time. Right? That people should learn every bit of, every minute is important. And the concept would be if it took 10 minutes or 15 minutes to get ready, so you'd have to get up 10 or 15 minutes early to get ready. This idea of discipline. You weren't even allowed to make up the time by learning more. You had to learn, this is the time. And the like. They say in Kelem that people who visited the yeshiva, and of course, needless to say, Rav Simcha Zissel was very makbid on neatness, on order. He basically said that when your external environment is orderly, again, it's conducive to serenity, that you may have heard the famous story, and it is a story about Rav Simcha Zissel, that he once went to visit his son who was learning at another yeshiva, and all he did was look at his son's dormitory room or wherever he was staying. And when he saw that that was in order, he went home without even seeing the son. Because he then said, I know things are okay.
That was a caricature about Kelem that made him into, like, silly people?
But anyway, be as it may, Kelem was not for everybody. I certainly would not have made it in Kelem at all. And in fact, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and if any of you knew Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Kamenetsky was more of a free spirit. I mean, if we can talk about a gadol that way. He was not someone who was so compulsive about all of these things. As a single boy, he went to Kelem for 6 months. And he used to tell the story of his first day in Kelem, that he comes to Kelem in Davening, and it was a day of Kriyas HaTorah. This is like the early 1900s. And Rav Simcha Zissel was actually not alive anymore, but Kelem continued until the Holocaust. And there seemed to be no Kohen for the Aliyah, so they were going to call up a Yisrael. And then Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky turned around and he noticed that a Kohen just entered the Beis HaMedrash. So he went over to the Gabbai and he said, there's a Kohen. So the Gabbai said to him, thank you very much, but that'll cost you a ruble. Or whatever. He says, why? He says, well, we're very grateful you told me there's a Kohen, but you're not supposed to look around during davening. If you're looking around who walks in and out, then our rules are you have to pay a fine. So it actually reminds me of a story I heard when I was in law school about in the Harvard University library. It was apparently totally destroyed in the 1700s. There was a big, big fire. And there was only one book that survived that somebody had taken without checking it out. So he goes back and he says, this is the only book that survived the fire. And they said, we're going to give you an award for saving the book, but you're also going to get expelled for taking the book without checking out. You know, and you're going to get expelled because you took the book without checking it out. You know, that type of thing. All right. So this is the same thing. So Rav Yaakov said later, he says, every person should spend 6 months in Kelem, but no more, as she said. So Kelem was a very, very tough place. And from our perspective, because we are a more pampered society, it looks like a boot camp. It looks very, very rigorous and the like, very Spartan. But in fact, there was actually a deep joy that many felt. It was the joy of mastery over yourself, over just knowing you were not a victim of moods that come and go. But you look at these moods as like a foreign thing that you can control and you can direct. And the people who've went through this process, they describe it as a very, very deep contentment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them this ability to control their lives, as it were. And in fact, let me point out that a lot of the kids came from wealthy families. I'm not sure if the tuition was high or something, but whatever it is, Kelem had Ashirim, Gevirim, in the Talmud Torah. And often, mothers wanted their kids to have special food, special treatments, whatever it is, and the Altar of Kelem did not allow it. And the mother said, what's wrong if I can afford it? I want to give my kids better treatment. So the Altar of Kelem said the following. It's interesting. He didn't use what you might call the Musser line of Taiva. He said the following. He said, if you can promise me that your son will live at this high standard the rest of his life, go ahead. Go ahead. But life changes. There are ups and downs. There are cycles of poverty. There's sickness. If someone gets used to the fact that this is the only way I can live, they're not going to develop the capacity to roll with the punches. And therefore, he said, it's important that people understand what is necessary, what is not necessary, and go with it. In fact, that's why Rav Scheinberg, you know, used to say that it's yeshivas shouldn't have good food. Rav Hashem is one of the directives that the yeshivas do listen to. Because he says, kids get spoiled, you know, etc. They get spoiled from their parents, and then they get spoiled in yeshiva, etc. There was this idea. Now, let me point out that Kelem was really the mother lode of Musar. Besides being the inspiration of the Altar Slobodka and the Vardik, which had a different shita, which I'll get to. But just to give you an example of who the Talmidim of Kelem were. Now, some of them were not from Rav Simcha Zissel, some of them were Rav Simcha Zissel's son. By the way, another very interesting figure, Rav Simcha Zissel had a son, Rav Hirsch Brody, who took over. But Rav Simcha Zissel's daughter, Nechama, was a very, very prominent person in the Musar movement. She was considered to be a spiritual leader in Kelem, not just for the women, but even for the men. Now, obviously, we're not talking about Maharats or female rabbis or whatever that is. If you don't know what I'm talking about, never mind. But you know, she behind the scenes as a tzanua, but she often gave people advice, and she was held up by her own father as the model of someone. And it's not really clear because he never explained it, but as someone who truly worked on her midos and struggled to become a righteous person, meaning apparently, I don't know, maybe she had a temper as a child or whatever it is, and he would point to her as the paragon of the person who can become a greater person. But her name was Nechama. She did get married, but I think she married a cousin, so I think her married name was also Brody. It was the same name. So she became like a famous personality in her own right. I think she was killed in the Holocaust. I mean, Simcha Zissel died in the late 19th century, and etc. Now, just to give you an example of the Talmidim who came out of Kelem, Rev Dessler came out of Kelem. Rev Elia Lapian came out of Kelem. Rev Yeruchim Levavitz, the great Mashgiach of Mir, came out of Kelem. Rev Yecheskel Levenstein, the Mashgiach of Panovich, came out of Kelem. So really, the Baalei Musar, based Kelem was the single most important. And again, and even the Altar of Slobodka and the Altar of the Vardik came out of Kelem, although they, I'll get into a moment, they did develop a very, very different approach to this. So Rav Simcha Zissel really was the one that was madrich. Again, he was not so involved with Balabatim, but in terms of Yeshiva B'nai Torah. And Rav Dessler left Kelem before World War II. Rav Dessler, as you know, before the World War II and during World War II, spent the years in England. And then after the war, he came to Eretz Yisrael. He became the Mashgiach of Panovich. In some ways, Rav Dessler was considered to be a little bit of a traitor to Kelem. traitor is a strong word. For the following reason. Rav Dessler introduced Chassidus into the study of Musar. And he tried to integrate Chassidus and Musar. And some of the old Kelemers, such as Rav Cheskel Levenstein, didn't like it, actually. They did not like it. So Rav Dessler was an innovator, but still, it was based on Kelem. Although, now that I'm saying this, it's interesting. I'll tell you a vort from the Altar of Kelem, which actually exemplifies what Rav Dessler actually did. In some ways, Rav Dessler was following the spirit of the Altar of Kelem. And that is, we read in yesterday's Parsha that the Yitzchak and Rivka didn't have children for 20 years. So the Pasuk says that they both prayed, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered Yitzchak. Rashi says, why Yitzchak and not Rivka? Because Yitzchak is a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, Avram, and Rivka is a tzaddikess, the daughter of a rasha, and therefore the prayer of a tzaddik ben tzaddik is greater than the prayer of a tzaddik ben Russia. So people ask the question, what do you mean? If anything, a tzaddik ben Russia is a bigger, is more righteous. A Baal Tshuva coming from such a background. If anything, we paskin, the Baal Tshuva is greater than the one that was born a tzaddik. So if anything, the prayer of Rivka should be greater than the prayer of Yitzchak. So the altar of Kelim says the following. The idea of a tzaddik ben tzaddik is that even though your father was a tzaddik, you become a tzaddik in your own derech, and you don't just blindly imitate. In other words, like this. With Rivka, once Rivka understood the emes, it was obvious she had to find her own way, and she couldn't just follow her father. But with Yitzchak, what better role model could there be than Avram Avinu? And yet, Yitzchak did not simply follow Avram's derech. He created his own derech, right? Avram is loving kindness, and Yitzchak is gevura. The altar of Kelim says, to be a tzaddik in your own way, even though you're a son of a tzaddik, is actually a greater and more difficult accomplishment than being a tzaddik when you come from a Russia. Because a tzaddik who comes from a Russia knows they have to find their own way. So in many ways, it's interesting, I just thinking about this now, that for Rav Dessler to kind of innovate and be machadesh and do something different is exactly what the altar of Kelim is saying, that you have to be a tzaddik ben tzaddik. So again, so look at all the personalities that came. Rav Yerucham Lubavitz, who became the Mashgiach of Mir, was then the Rebbe of Rav Volba, right? So, and many, many, many others as well. So, and Rav Volba has Talmidim as well. So really, the main shalshelis, the main chain of Musar came through Kelim. Rav Dessler was already out of Kelim by the time of the Holocaust, but his uncle was still in Kelim, he had many, many relatives, and Rav Dessler records in the Michtav Me'Eliyahu, the eyewitness accounts that he received of the Nazi massacre of the Talmud Torah in Kelim. And as you might expect, you know, one of the things, the Nazis, besides, of course, physically destroying so many Jews, the Nazis wanted to also wage a lot of psychological warfare. They wanted Jews to be humiliated. They wanted Jews to be scared. They wanted Jews to be frightened. They wanted Jews to beg, although the begging wouldn't help. And in Kelim, as you would expect, they went to their death, now again, pejoratively, a secular or a God-insensitive person would say they went like sheep to slaughter. That is not how Rav Dessler defines it. They went with dignity, with calmness, with serenity, preparing themselves to die al kiddush Hashem. There was no crying, there were no tears, there was no shouting, there was no rushing around. Basically, the message was, we lived our lives to serve God, and now it is the time to be willing to die to serve God for reasons we don't know. And we will accept Hashem's decrees with love. And it is recorded that this discombobulated the Nazis themselves. They didn't even know how to deal with it. I mean, they were reluctant to even start shooting because they thought, are we shooting angels? Are we shooting human beings? Who are these people? Nobody's begging. Nobody's crying. And it says that the Nazis themselves, on some level, it even affected them. Of course, they were able to be kovesh their Yetzer Tov, and they did what they did. But this is what the Kedusha was, and this was Kalman. Rav Dessler writes a beautiful eulogy and an elegy over the destruction of that type of inner spiritual strength. Now, when Tirta said the reputation of them being fools, that was not about Kelim, it was about Nevardik. I'll get to Nevardik. Nevardik had a certain reputation that I'll get to. Kelim, if anything, was the opposite. Again, in Kelim, there was a big emphasis on what you might call superficiality. In other words, neatness. People were dressed impeccably. In fact, they say Rav Simcha Zissel's son, Rav Hirsch Brody, even had a dog because a gentleman in Europe was supposed to have a pet, so to speak, and it was important that a religious Jew be seen as a dignified person, as opposed to just a bench kvetcher or whatever it was. So there was a big emphasis on chitzonius and on speaking in a soft tone and the like. Yeah. Okay. No, you know, you are correct. I wasn't, Chelm was not unique. But what is interesting is that in almost every case when Jews went to their deaths that way, and it happened quite a lot, the Nazis were disoriented. The Nazis themselves didn't know how to process that type of information. They had not seen a human being able to transcend the natural terror that a person has. You are correct. But Chelm was the example that Rav Dessler recorded because This is what he was aware of. So this is the altar of Chelm. Now, the altar of Slobodka, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel. Fascinating person. We know nothing about him till his early 30s. Mystery man. All sorts of rumors. Perhaps in his youth he was a member of the Haskalah. Perhaps he was moving to the Enlightenment, etc. But he met, when he was around 30, he met Rav Yisrael Salanter. And Rav Yisrael Salanter saw the altar's organizational talents and his oratorical talents, and he encouraged the altar to become a Jewish educator and a mechanech par excellence, and he sent him to his disciple Rav Simcha Zissel of Chelm. By the way, one more thing about Chelm. Rav Simcha Zissel did not allow any titles to be used, including for himself. So when he was called up to the Torah, he was just called up Simcha Zissel Ben, whatever his father was. There were no titles. He says, we are all equal here. We are here to be Avdei Hashem and to serve Hashem. And there is no concept of hierarchy. They say in Kelim as well, yeah, I'll get back to the Altar of Slobodka in a moment. They say in Kelim as well, consistent with the idea that you're not supposed to look behind you, that even a bomb went off. Again, I'm not sure if the halacha this is correct. They didn't look. They didn't look. They focused on what they were doing. And conversely, if a visitor left something in the Beis Medrash, like a cane or whatever it would be, it would still be there 20 years later. They would clean around it and leave it there. By the way, I'll tell you a story. Rav Elia Lapian, as I indicated, was a Talmud of Kelim. So let me give you a story about Rav Elia Lapian. Rav Elia Lapian, I mean, he died, he probably died in the mid-1970s. I mean, there are many people who remember Rav Elia Lapian. And one time he was in his 90s. He was Zocha to Arichas Yomim. And he was in Yerushalayim doing something that we all do. He was waiting for a bus. And he had a little Mishnayos. And he was learning the Mishnayos. And the bus was late. 5 minutes late, 10 minutes late, 15 minutes late, 20 minutes late. He's learning the Mishnayos. Everybody's going crazy. He's learning the Mishnayos. After 20 minutes, apparently the bus, you know, one bus skipped or whatever it is, he looks up from the Mishnayos to see if the bus is coming. And then he immediately breaks into tears. He says, I'm 90 years old and all that I learned in Kelim has left me. Why am I looking up to see if the bus is coming? When it comes, it'll be here. Right now I am serving Hashem, and I impatient, I'm allowing myself, and he considered that to be a very big pagam, that he looked up to see if the bus is coming. Again, as Rav Yaakov said, Kelim is not for everybody. but it's a certain type of model as to what a person might aspire to in microcosm and the like. Now, when we come to the altar of Slobodka, as I say, his early years are very enigmatic. He seems to have come from nowhere, as it were. In fact, it's interesting. His name, Nosson Zvi Finkel, if you rearrange the letters, can be Tzafon, the hidden one. Tzadik Pei Nun, and that is how he signed himself. He signed his name Tzadik Pei Nun, the hidden one. In fact, the Altar of Slobodka's Shmuzin are called Or Hatzafun. Now, Remember, tell your boys, if they have the sefer, it is not Or Hatzafon, as a lot of people. It is not the light of the north. It is Or Hatzafon, the concealed light, because his name was Nosson Tzvi Finkel, and he was very, very concealed. The Alter Slobodka, as I say, initially, was a Talmud of Rishon Lezion, but most of his apprenticeship, he was already an older person. He was not that much younger than the Alter of Kelem, but he became a Talmud of the Alter of Kelem. But eventually what happened was they had a falling out. They had a very, very different shita. And I'm going to have to leave it for next time, but I just want to say that if the Alter of Kelem's emphasis was self-mastery and serenity, and I'm simplifying because there's a lot more, but we could take this as the most important. The Alter of Slobodka believed in emphasizing what is called Gadlus HaAdam, the greatness of a man, the greatness of a human being. And his basic idea was to focus that because we are in the image of God, each one of us is godly. And if a person recognizes, man and woman, recognizes their importance, their dignity, their chashivas, their beauty, the kochos that God put into us, then a person is not going to sin, because how could I besmirch something that is so beautiful? How could I dishonor the Tselem Elokim within me, and how could I not see the Tselem Elokim in the other? Now, it is said that the Alter of Slobodka's 50 years of Hadracha, based on Gadlus HaAdam, were based on the first shmooze he heard from Chizizizizel. Or Chizizizel talked about many things, and mainly serenity and control. But it happened to be the first day the Alter of Slobodka came to Kelem, the Alter of Kelem gave a shmooze about Gadlus HaAdam and Tselem Elokim, and that shmooze was the seed of 50 years of the Alter of Slobodka's teaching of Gadlus HaAdam. The Alter of Slobodka was the head of the Slobodka Yeshiva, but I'll talk about that. Let me just point out that his Talmidim were Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov Ruderman, my Rosh Yeshiva, many, 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 many great Gedolei Torah. And although the Alter of Slobodka was not the Rosh Yeshiva, in fact, he wasn't even the Mashgiach. He actually had no job at all. It's very interesting. He was the head of the yeshiva, but in a totally unofficial way. And that is why it's pointed out that in his emphasis on creativity and individuality, there were two types of students who emerged from the Slobodka yeshiva. One were the Eloyim, who became the Gedolei Hador, and there were a lot of Apikorsim who came as well, because this is the danger that every institution faces. If instead of producing cookie cutter, you want to emphasize, find your niche, find your talents, be creative, be an individual, tap into your hidden greatness, some people are going to go in a different direction. And that indeed was the risk. Yeah.